This is a speaker meeting. Ruby will speak for 10 minutes and then turn over the meeting to our main speaker, Josh, who will share his experience, strength, and hope. Now I'd like to turn the meeting over to Ruby.
Okay. Wait. What's up? Hello, my name is Ruby. I am an alcoholic. An assortment of other things. So I didn't really plan on what I was going to say before I came here. I just came here, and so I'm just going to talk now at you. So I have a sobriety date of November 15th, 2012. I went to a rehab in Chicago, Illinois. I am from here. Well, not here. I grew up in a tiny town about an hour and a half from here. It was like 2.5 blocks. Everybody knew everybody. But I realized if I was going to quit drinking and go to a rehab, I was going during like Thanksgiving and Christmas and New Year's. I wanted to at least go somewhere where it was going to be snowy. So I did that. I started drinking, I think when I had my first drink when I was probably about 7 or 8. I started drinking like sips of wine with my parents, but I really started drinking like champagne and special occasions when I was, I think, 11 or 12 for like New Year's Eve and Christmas and things like that. But my drinking really took off when I was in high school. I transferred high schools because I was very badly bullied in middle school and elementary school. I grew up with all the same kids from kindergarten through eighth grade, and I was very charming and good looking when I was young. And with that came some very sexy name calling, and that is extremely sarcastic. So I transferred to a high school about a half an hour away from my house and found like the kind of what I called my version of like the punk rock scene, and decided to immediately change my look and give myself a haircut. I had very long curly hair, which you cannot tell right now. And I had my sister cut off my ponytail with like those orange handled scissors one night and bleach it. And there wasn't enough bleach in the box. This is just a funny story. Enough bleach in the box for my whole head of hair. So the front was like that really nice like hay colored like yellow funky. It was great. And the back was still like blackish brown, and I held on to that look, and I dyed the front kind of green and one side was pink, and I would wear like pajama pants and fishnets together with a dress, and I would go to school that way, and it was really awesome. And I carried a briefcase as my backpack, and I didn't really understand why I didn't have a ton of friends or why boys didn't like me. And my mom brought it to my attention that I looked like a West County dyke, so I decided to grow out my hair. My mom had some really good nicknames for me. I had pretty low self-esteem, and I think that's why I really started drinking a lot. I started drinking when I was a freshman. I started drinking alone. I started drinking warm vodka that I would buy from a girl who was in my choir class from a Sprite bottle. It just progressed from there. I went to a lot of parties. I would get really drunk. And my friends, when I would come back to school on Monday, would be like, "Hey, drunkie." And I was like, "Yeah, finally part of the team." And so after high school, I went to college, and my drinking really like accelerated. I also started using prescription drugs. Every time I got into an accident, it was like heyday. And I was very clumsy. I broke my foot in a ridiculous sexapade when I was drunk and I fell off the bed and I broke my foot. And so I was, it was during the Olympics, and so everybody said that I had a bad dismount. It was really great. So I was prescribed Vicodin, and so I would just continue on that, and I would drink while I was taking the Vicodin, and I would take like six or seven, and I would a couple of glasses of vodka. And I would look, and I had this good friend of mine, and I would look at her, and I remember this one night, and I was licking a wooden spoon, and I looked at her, and I said, "Should this be working?" Because I wanted the spoon. I was like, "The spoon still tastes like a spoon. Shouldn't it be working by now?" Because I thought it was like a hallucinogen. It wasn't. So I would start mixing. I just continued doing that. And I would drink. I drank alone. I'm sorry, my brain's a little frazzled. 10 minutes is long and not very long. So my drinking really hit its peak when I was about 20 years old. My best friend was killed in an accident. And so I was extremely depressed and very suicidal, but I knew I couldn't kill myself because it would hurt my mom's feelings. So I would just drink an obscene amount by myself, and I would write out all these suicide letters and then put them in a drawer and just hold on to them and like wait for the right moment. And I continued to drink like that for 3 years. And I would put things in his place to try and like have a connection with him or fill that God-sized hole. And so I would drink an obsessive amount, I would drink obsessively. I would wake up in the morning and I would put like a little Kahlua in my coffee, and then I would go to work and I would drink. I worked at a bar. I was a waitress at a bar. So I would drink my coffee and go to work, and I would drink a bunch of Red Bull to like get rid of the hangover and be ready to like be a waitress until 2 a.m. And then I would get shots from my customers, and I would go home and I would make it to the 7-Eleven before it closed, and I would drink until like 6 a.m. I'd fall asleep and I'd do it all over again, and I would put men in the place of like that emptiness I felt, and I would put drugs in the place of that emptiness I felt, and it continued and it continued and continued until I couldn't go anymore. And I had gotten a DUI, and a week later I wrecked my car, and I continued to drive once I got my car back, drunk for another year, and nothing was stopping me. Nothing could possibly stop me. And what finally brought me to my knees was I had lost a best friend. I dropped out of school so that I could work more at my bar. And the people I worked with were like, "Hey, you have a drinking problem and we can't trust you, and we're worried about you because you leave your car at the bar for like 3 days in a row and take a cab home." And like, I lived a half an hour away from the bar, so that was like an $80 cab ride that I would do like 3 days in a row, because I was like, "I'm gonna get drunk anyway, it's cool, I'll spend my tips on the cab." Like, the cab driver knew my house. I lived like in the middle of nowhere. And I was in a long relationship, and he left me. He said that he couldn't take it anymore. He couldn't be with somebody who couldn't take care of themselves. And I was suffering from a serious eating disorder too, and my body was falling apart. My hair was falling out, my teeth were chipping. I was just a complete mess, and I the only thing that was keeping me together was drinking. It was the only thing that gave me any pleasure, and it stopped working. So I went to my mother and I told her that I couldn't survive and I couldn't keep going. And she was like, "Are you sure? Are you sure that you need to go?" And I was like, yeah. Like, I've been hiding a noose under my sink for 2 years, and I'm pretty sure I'm going to use it. So I went to this place in Chicago. I was there for 2 months. And when I got discharged, I went to an outpatient in San Francisco for 3 months. And I moved here to Oakland afterwards. And I was dry for about 6 months. And being dry is not, if any of you have done it, it pretty much is like, it's like being drunk without the fun. I did all the same dumb shit. I made all the same dumb mistakes. I isolated. I didn't sleep. When I did sleep, I slept for like 2 days. I didn't pick up my phone. I didn't have any respect for myself or the people around me. And I was a complete mess. And so I was really depressed one night, and I was about to call my neighbor to have him like take me to a bar so I could order a non-alcoholic beer just to be around my people. And I was like, oh shit, I need to go to a meeting. So I went, and that night I met my sponsor. She was talking, and I just like did not gently go up to her and was like, "Hey, I need a sponsor. Sponsor me now." And I've been in the program ever since, very intensely. And what's changed about my life now is that when I'm really stressed out and can't feel like I can't breathe or can't move, I read from the big book and I write and I call people. And I pick up my phone. Today I was feeling like hell and I couldn't get out of my bed until like 2 o'clock. But I was writing and working on the steps. And my phone rang and it was my best friend who's in the psych ward because she wanted to kill herself. So I was able to go in rush hour traffic on a Saturday. Why is that a thing? And it is. And I was able to go to the psych ward and God, and I was able to like hang out with her in the psych ward. So this is how I get the fellas. It's true. That's the moneymaker. No, it's not. It's not. I was able to. I was able to go and make myself available to her and like spend a day with her, and I was able to come here after and know that I needed to be here and like blurt my shit out and still put on a smile and know that like I don't have to drink over that, you know? I don't have to drink over, you know, life still happens, but this is a miracle. Like, I don't want to know what the miracle is in AA, but it is a fucking miracle. So that is it.
And now I would like to turn the meeting over to our other speaker, Josh, our main speaker.
My name's Josh. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Josh.
I don't know how main I am, but thank you for having me. Thanks, Brian. Thanks, Victor. And yeah, thanks, Ruby, also. So for the most part, I'm deeply attached with your perceptions of me. And you know, I spend a lot of time thinking about what other people think of me, and I tell little stories about what they're thinking. And looking at you, the one story I think you're thinking is, that fucking guy's old. And it is true, I am indeed old, but you know, I'll tell you, that concern for other people's perceptions, and I'll tell you a little about an experience I had when I was still getting loaded. I was homeless, and you know, being homeless actually didn't bother me very much, but what troubled me was the idea of somebody seeing me. be homeless. And that's the truth of it. My actual situation was not as troubling to me as the fear of being discovered and having people understand who I really was. And I got through, you know, like many of you as a bright kid, and I got by on brains and bullshit for many years, you know, and many of us have. There's a lot of bright people in Alcoholics Anonymous. And what it gets is, you know, it kind of gets you through life skating without actually doing any work. And as you grow into adulthood, it's really a challenge to grow accustomed that you know, being a grown-up takes work. Making it in this deal takes work. I stand before you, and I may not look like you. I may not be in the same age group. I'm Jewish. I may not be same, you know, culture. But I'll tell you, if you've ever stolen from your parents, maybe you know the way I felt. And maybe if you've ever woken up and reflected on the fact that, you know, the things that you said you never do, I'm never going to sell this jewelry my family gave me. And I'm never going to sell these power tools that I make a living with. I'm never going to sell my ass. All those things, when you look back behind you, then maybe you know the way I felt, you know, because I woke up that way many times. Ashamed of the things that I said I'd never do, and I did anyway. And one of the things that happened to me frequently, in fact, constantly, was that I woke up every morning, and I said, I'm not going to get loaded today. I'm not going to get loaded today. And every day I ended up loaded. And, you know, every day I woke up and I promised. I promised not only other people, but I promised myself that I wasn't going to get loaded today. And every day I ended up loaded. You know, and so what that did for me, one of the effects of that was that it eroded not only other people's trust in me, but it eroded the trust I had in myself. So it eroded my ability to make a commitment to do anything and follow up on it. And in active alcoholism, I think one of the really big things, I couldn't finish a fucking thing, you know? I could make commitments and I couldn't keep them. I could start shit and I couldn't finish it. You know, I could tell you I would be there, but I wouldn't. And I'll tell you also, during this period, I had absolutely the best intentions. I'm not a sociopath, and I'm actually not a particularly mean-spirited or evil person. And so my intention was to really be a good person. I was just incapable of doing it. You know, I wanted to be, like, I saw people be friends to other people, and they'd show up for them. You know, I saw people go to family gatherings, and, you know, I had a family at one time, and I wanted to appear for those things, but I was incapable of doing it. I couldn't keep a fucking commitment. I could not tell the truth, and I could not do what I said. And towards the end of this deal, you know, when you've betrayed people constantly and you've lied constantly, people no longer believe what you say. So from that place, you know, from that place to the place I am now, you know, I stand before you. And the big deal for me, welcome to the new people. I hope you're done. Because, you know, we know a lot of people try to get sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. I attend a lot of meetings, and I you know, people know I do, I sponsor guys and go to the Salvation Army and stuff. I see a lot of guys, I see a lot of people, and nobody's ever gotten sober until they're done. So, you know, hope it's bad enough. And it sounds kind of harsh, but I know that it wasn't bad enough for me, and I continue to get loaded. I went to jail, and that was not sufficient. I went, I violated felony probation. I was arrested. So they put you in jail for 90 days. And my sister got brain cancer. And the judge released me after 30 days. But he said, I'll be glad to release you a little early. But I'm going to put a year of penitentiary time over your head if you violate this probation. And that means if you test dirty, if you commit any misdemeanors. They have the right to search you, or go inside your car, your house, your friends, anything. With that condition over my head, so at great personal risk, the immediate thing I did was get loaded. So you got to think, what's the mind that says, I'm going to go to the penitentiary. There's not a huge Jewish contingent in the penitentiary. You know, and become somebody's lovely wife. And yet still, it was not sufficient. The threat of that happening was not sufficient to make me stop drinking. So there's very little question that I am an alcoholic, because at great peril, I'm willing to risk the things that are critical to me in order to get high again. And the evidence has been, you know, repeated. You know, almost all the time, I see times when the decisions I made, many times I was given an opportunity. I you know, was a bright guy, was charming, as Ruby was talking about, but, you know, I've been given opportunities. I was hired for jobs and simply had to pass the drug test. It's not like really like a 3.5 hour multiple choice, you know. It's not an essay, fucking. You just have to urinate without drugs in your urine. Yet, you know, I knew I was drug testing on Tuesday. It was Sunday night, and I went out to score again. You know, it's that. You know it's not going to work, but just before you do it, you're like, I can do this. There's probably some way, you know, I can swing this. But I missed it. You know, I was unable to grasp the reality that I was going to fuck off a job that was really hard to get because I was just incapable of not drinking or using. And so I had plenty of evidence. So like I said, you know, although I may not look exactly the same or dress the same, you know, if ever you've betrayed people who have trusted you, then maybe you know the way that I felt. You know, if ever you've you know, made a commitment to help some other person and simply didn't show up and didn't call, then you know the guy that I am, and maybe you understand the way I feel. Let me see. So, I'll tell you a story. Let me tell you a story, a little story. This is a recent story. So this is... month ago, I have some teeth. One of the things I got in sobriety in Alcoholics Anonymous was I got my teeth fixed. I you know, I practice dental health, and so you know, 30 years of daily alcohol and drug abuse actually has an impact on your dental hygiene and living. So I have some teeth that are called implants, right? And they're titanium posts, and they put, you know, a toothy thing on top of it, right? And I don't know the technical term, but it's a twofer. I'm almost positive. And I was eating an apple, and it broke that little twofer part off, you know, and then swallowed it. And I was like, I'll get it later. You're not gonna get it later. No matter how you try, you won't get it later. But you know, the thing to have done was it would have been to induce vomiting immediately, probably. I mean, the thing costs $3,500, you know. Should probably induce vomiting immediately. But I didn't, and because I was embarrassed, you know, I was outdoors and I could. So you know, the one that I broke was right next to your two front upper teeth, right? So it's a prominent absence of a tooth in my mouth. And so, you know, just bear with me for a second. You know, you have a hole in your face, and you have the wherewithal to repair it. But you know, I knew who put that thing in, and that guy was an oral surgeon. He was an oral surgeon, and at the time he was in Oakland. So you know, Leon said, you know, why don't you just go to the dentist, right? I'm like, no, I gotta find this oral surgeon. So I like did this Google search, and you know, and like a week later, I tracked him down to Foster City or Union City or some fucking city. And, you know, and I called and left messages, and another week went by. Yet still remains the hole in my face. And, you know, Leanne said, why don't you go to the dentist? And so, you know, I did some further research, You know, so finally, like 3 weeks have gone by, and so Leanne has to go to have a procedure at Kaiser, and so I'm sitting out there, and I get this little text called the dentist from Leanne, you know, with a phone number. So I call her dentist, and I'm like, you know, I'm calling it, and it was pretty much, you know, the guy's not going to see me, I'm a new patient, you know, it's going to be weeks, this is going to cost millions of dollars, it's totally fucked up. I call and I start to tell the same long story that I'm telling you. They're like, can you come in at 8 tomorrow morning? I was like, okay, I'll come in at 8. Next morning, you know, I came in at 8 in the morning, and I started to tell this long story, which I've just told you the entire, and the doctor said, do me a favor, just sit down for a quick second. So I sat down, and there's a bunch of stuff in my mouth, and I'm trying to tell the long story that I just told you. And the guy starts fucking around in my mouth, and like 11 minutes later, he finally stops so I can tell him the long story that I just told you. And in fact, he built a new tooth during that 11-minute period. So the moral of the story is, when you have a dental problem, go to the dentist. The other moral of the story is, don't listen to your head. And why do I share the story? What does it have to do with sobriety and Alcoholics Anonymous? The story of that is the story of my alcoholism. It's that I know a better way to do things, that I can manipulate this to my advantage, that although I'm receiving loving, helpful suggestions, they are not sufficient to motivate me to take the right steps. I'm up in my head all the fucking time. You know, and also I believe I'm an authority on everything. You know? So yet, that's yet another story I tell myself. I tell myself, you know, that in order for me to speak before a group of people, you know, I'm going to have to impress you with marvelous humor and wisdom, and I'll need to be impressive, and, you know, all of these things in order that you give me the approval and the attention and the affection that I so direly need, you know, in order to be whole. And that's a little story I tell myself. And the truth of the matter is, and you know, and that's a reoccurring theme in my life. You know, and I don't think I'm the only one who experiences feelings of inadequacy or a lack of worth, you know, and that I need to create something that generates some kind of response. So what I've learned in Alcoholics Anonymous, and one of the things that I've learned is I've grown some filters. You know, I've grown some filters. And there's people in this room who know me for years. Jeff is one of them, who've seen me grow some filters. And part of what I'm talking about is simply being compelled to utter things regardless of the impact that those things have. So when things tumble out of my mouth that are entirely inappropriate to the group I'm addressing and the situation at hand, a lot of times bad shit happens. You know, broken facial features and... You know, but not only that, but also I alienate people. And, you know, an overwhelming degree of sarcasm and better than and snippishness and smarminess and all that stuff. Although those things are at one point in our life a place where we go and do our thing with our friends, that's actually not the way I want to live. That's not the guy I want to be. It was, and it was fine for a while. It worked okay. It's not working for me anymore. Because that's not the guy I want. Because I've seen other people interact, and I've seen myself interact, and I know something. And I know that that love is wisdom, you know? That that kindness is wisdom. So, you know, if I'm going to express some degree of wisdom, if I can convey some message, if I can transmit something, you know, today, may it be kindness, you know? May it be that. And that's not something I learned in the first year or the second year or the third year of Alcoholics Anonymous. It's AA 201, but it's also newcomer AA. You know, one of the deals that it's really hard to convey to somebody who's new is be kind to yourself. This is a tough deal, you know. All we have done up until the point where we're done and is hurt ourselves and others. So we have this history, all of us, have this history of hurting other people and feeling hurt and feeling like a little bit of victim, feeling like a sort of an object of circumstance, feeling buffeted about, and not being particularly forgiving or kind to self. And from my experience, that kindness towards others is one of the ways that we're able to start channeling kindness towards self. Sounds airy-fairy. All I'm trying to say is if people talk about being of service. You know, if you don't really have anything to offer, you know, just be kind. It works out really well. It's something that's pretty easy to transmit, and it's something that was done for me in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I think we heard Thursday night at Chips and Cake, some of the people heard Walter talk about people saving his life, you know. And people do save our lives around here. And we heard from Zephyr talking about, you know, people, you know, giving him a bowl of granola and a bed and a floor to sleep on, you know. That's the shit we do. And that's the stuff we have to do. Nobody's a big shot around here. I'm not going to impress you. You know, I can't impress you. There's nothing I have that's going to impress you particularly. All I can do is convey to you that I have a practice that has kept me sober. I had 7 years on Cinco de Mayo, and I'm grateful for those 7 years. You know, I have a practice, and the practice for me is that I wake up in the morning. We wake up at 5, and we have some coffee. We sit quietly, and we read some daily books, and we read some spiritual books, and we say some prayers, and we sit in meditation, because of the grace of others and some stuff that was handed to me, I can sit down quietly for 20 minutes. It isn't particularly fucking sophisticated. You know, you set your timer for 20 minutes and you sit there. I think about stuff, and I think about work, and I worry, and I project fear. All those things happen. I have no control over my thoughts, you know? I sit for 20 minutes. And when that's done, you know, we make lunches for my guys, and we go on about our work, and we do our deal. You know, I attend a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I have a couple home groups. I'm one of the MST guys, and Dr. Bob's, and you know, I go to the Adeline group, and I do this. I'm the guy that does that Salvation Army deal. It goes out to Salvation Army Recovery Center in Oakland. And we talk to some guys, and we try to. You know, we try to do this deal where we might bring something that for a moment is attractive enough that someone else might desire. I know that's a stretch too. So you're saying, so we have to come off like something desirable. That's not the case. I think for me, a life that allows me to be comfortable in my own skin, to feel as though I am actually indeed an esteemable person, but to know for a fact that my experience has a value. It's not just a history of broken hearts in my wake and broken dreams and dishonesty behind me. It's an overall experience that, in fact, can benefit others. And so I have this practice. I go to those meetings. I do my deal in the morning. You know, I have guys in my life like Sean, who I love incredibly, who's helped me so much, keep me sober. We do this stuff and we meet at my house, and our house is a place like, you know, like, I don't know if you've met the old-timey sponsors. You go to their house and they feed you, you know, and you know, and both the people and the couple are both sponsors, and it's comfortable and it's safe, and that's what our house is. And that is my biggest aspiration, and the thing I feel most gratified with is that my house is our house is a safe place for other people to go, and sometimes they're not in the most, you know, they're not happy all the time, you know, but it's a safe place. And I know Brian and Carolyn have that kind of a thing too, where there are people, you know, who feel safe with them. And so that's part of my practice. So I can't tell you a great deal about God. I can tell you that what I do have faith in, I have faith in that practice. So, I don't know anything about, you know, how the mix of a higher power, because this is a spiritual program, but I do know that I have faith in that practice, that I will stay sober if I continue that particular practice. I have empirical evidence behind me that I can stay sober with that practice of serving others, attending AA meetings, being sponsored by Phil and sponsoring others. You know, you don't have to do all of those things. No one has to do anything I did. But I can tell you, I don't know which of those things is the thing that keeps me sober, so I've got to do all of those things. Because in the event that things actually get bad, that's when I'm going to need to be sober. You know, a lot of us get a lot of stuff back in sobriety, and the significance of a practice somehow becomes diminished. And, you know, we hear it all the time at meetings. You know, I got sober, I got my shit, and, you know, everything's going to be okay. You know, I have my kids. Everything's going to be okay when I buy my house. Everything's going to be okay when my kids graduate. Everything's going to be okay when I get my promotion. And I can't have faith in the future. Because then I'm just not living in this moment. It's not sufficient to me. I don't have faith that that future will happen for me. All I've got to do is get through this fucking deal today. I got to get through this deal, this one, right now. And although I fail about being graceful all the time, and I frequently stumble, I am human, and I'm clearly alcoholic, so it's important that I tell you another story. That was pretty serious for a moment, I know. It's kind of dreadful. So, tell you a little story. I was driving. It was last week, so it was long, long ago. Last week, I was driving on Highway 880 going westbound from some, you know, bumfuck. And I was heading west. And you know, I was approaching that big sweeping right turn to Highway 80 that all of you know. It's, you know, the one in that corner over there. And, you know, you get up there, it's 4:41 in the afternoon on a weekday. I believe it was a Friday, probably. So you've navigated the whole week, you know, you're in your vehicle, and then traffic backs up because it's rush hour, and, you know, you're heading pretty much outbound from the city now. You catch all the outbound guys from the city. And there's a carpool lane right next to me. Perfectly good carpooling, but I'm by myself, and I'm not in that carpool lane, and I'm resenting those who are. And let me tell you what I resent more than three people using the carpool. Just for a minute, one fucking person using the carpool. So I'm stuck in traffic, and all these single people are shooting by in the carpool lane. You know, one seemed all right. 3, 9, 31, and we're stuck in fucking traffic. You know, so, in my esteemed position as arbiter of other people's driving, I made an important executive decision. I decided that they could no longer proceed with this charade. So what I did, it's important to note that the vehicle I drive for work, my truck is, it has four doors, it's four-wheel drive, it has an 8-foot bed, it's approximately the size of this room, and about as attractive, frankly, as well. So, people are coming, I can see in my rearview mirror that it's somebody by themselves. I'm just gonna fucking cruise out into the carpool lane and hang out there, just stop. Because, lest you forget, I am the arbiter of other people's driving. The thing I failed to remember was that it's my company truck. It's covered with signage with my name and my phone number. So, you know, then I everybody's kind of, all the ones stacked up for a while, and then I got back over into my lane. Victory at last. And off they go. Each person, flip me off. Each one. Story's not over yet. The story ends with the emails I received the next day from all those fucking drivers. And, you know, for the most part, the email said, you know, really, it's a bad idea to pull out in front of 40-mile-an-hour traffic to show us that only three people are what needs to use the carpool lane. The point is, I think everyone recognizes that there are things that happen in this world that make us and make me uncomfortable, that create resentment for me, that people cheat occasionally, you know, like, I know I do, you know, and people cheat with the diamond line, whatever you call it, you know, the carpool lane, you know. And it's none of my fucking business, frankly. It's none of my business what other people do or how other people drive, and it's probably not personal. You know, for the most part, as they zoomed by me, they had not given me an actual thought whatsoever. Not nearly a thought about me. So, you know, that being said, it goes to self-focusedness. And so I talk a little bit about the significance of me and how it relates to my downfall. And for me, you know, we read, in the morning reading, we read some stuff, some Buddhist stuff, some Thich Nhat Hanh stuff, which is Buddhism and Christianity together, talking about some similarities, and I'm Jewish. So we explore all different paths, right? And we read this stuff about the dissolution of the self. You know, then we read other stuff that says it's really significant that our perception of our self is probably a false perception. Then we read other stuff that says, like, we have a divine self that's kind of aligned with God's will. And then we have our regular self that functions on this world, you know, on this earth. And it makes mistakes and it makes poor decisions, and then it recalibrates and tries to get back to the divine self. And I like that analogy. You know, there's times when we know we're behaving well, we're acting appropriately, we're in harmony with our higher power's will for us. You know, and that, you know, and there's a strong feeling, there's a strong sense of union during those moments. It's typically not very long lasting, but I think we've all experienced it, being in harmony, doing the right thing. And, you know, so what I've found is, you know, historically speaking, my experience with the self is that I spend a great deal of time separating my self from other people's self and from my divine self. And part of the ways I do it is through attachments to material stuff. So material stuff's fine. Nothing wrong with cool material stuff. But it's my attachments to them, you know? And it's my attachments to people. You know, it's great to be in a healthy romantic relationship, but it's also important not to have this incredible sense of attachment to it. You know, because I can't fucking cling to things to make them mine. I can't attach possession to it. I don't have the capacity to own you or to own my shit. This is temporary, you know? I'm just on doing this deal a day at a time. You know, and the more I become attached to stuff and to people and to the future, the more trouble I have. And part of what I need to do, I guess, I imagine, is to be able to accurately appraise myself and my universe for that matter. So one of the things, you know, that I guess for that, you know, I don't know. I'm really interested. I really wonder what you people think about it. For me, an ability to accurately assess what's really going on instead of the story I tell myself. And it's a huge fucking deal. You know, this narrative that I have that, you know, if I can't control this deal, it's not going to happen. You know, and I'm sure people have experienced this. You know, we do a thing, and, you know, if you stand back and see what happens, you'll certainly figure out what's going to happen by, you know, sitting back. But I do a thing, I make a decision, I issue a directive, and then I've got to sit and fucking micromanage it to death until people resent me. You know, I micromanaged the dishes the other day. It's ridiculous, you know. So these are things that happen with years of sobriety. The manifestation of self-centeredness and self-focusedness are areas that I need work, you know. Control stuff is the way it manifests. And there's areas where I need work. So, you know, some of the ways I'm able to do it, you know, of course, there's a seventh step. I mean, I pray to have some help with this stuff. It clearly doesn't happen instantaneously, as evidenced by the carpool lane story last week. You know, I can't control stuff, but I still give it a valiant effort. You know, but for the most part, I'm able to stand before you and say, this is the person whom I am. I'm okay with it. My history is, this is the practice I have in AA. You know, I was beaten to a state of reasonableness. I was able to quit for a second. I didn't have any tools when I arrived here. All I had was drugs and alcohol were my two coping tools. If you're new and you feel uncomfortable, it's typical. You know, we arrive here, you know, we have these two tools, drugs and alcohol. That's all we have. They say we'll be presented with a kit of spiritual tools. They're not presented on the first day of service. You know, those will be forthcoming. But for now, just don't get loaded today. Hang on to somebody overnight to show up tomorrow. And you know, you might come across those tools later on. One of the tools that has worked for me is calling other people. As Walter said really eloquently last night, you know, the other thing to do is try to reach out to the person next to you, even if you don't know them, even if they're not, you know, the same whatever. You know, reach out to somebody next to you and, you know, do a little kindness. Try to be of service to those people around you. Do the best you can. I'm grateful to be here. I'm grateful to be serving.